objective? Ask Greg, well, do you have an objective? Has anybody got any guidance? No? Okay. In fact, the title originally was The History of the Jews, and I thought, well, that wasn't quite rich enough, so we decided to go back and cover the history of Israel, essentially from the time it became a nation, just before the Exodus, and cover that all the way up to AD 70. We hope to relate biblical events to world historical events, if we can, and provide some details not presented in the Scriptures and how they relate, say, to the Scriptures. I thought, you know, I need some help. So, you know, a few years ago I taught a class on between the Testaments, and so Farrell Jenkins had written a book entitled Between the Testaments. So I contacted Farrell and I said, I'd like your book. And he said, well, it's out of print and I don't have any copies, but I'm developing some class materials to, you know, teach a course on Between the Testaments. Not done, but I'll loan you the outline. So he sent me the outline, and I used that, again, to structure a class in 10 lessons on Between the Testaments. And I sent, I told Farrell, you know, I'm supposed to teach this in one quarter. And he said this. This sounds like some requests I get for meeting topics. They know not what they ask. This topic is so broad it could take a few years to cover. So that was encouraging, you know. But good, in 10 lessons. He begged off. He said, you know, most of my real expertise is AD 70 and forward, modern Israel. But he referred me to Marty Pickup. He said, Marty's kind of an expert. He's done a lot of work in that area, done a lot of study. Marty will help you. So I sent Marty my email and Farrell's response. And he said, well, Farrell's right. Yeah, that didn't help a lot. And but he did provide me a 2-page list of reference books and said, good luck. So, but we went back and forth with a few emails, and we finally picked 3 books. And I bought those books, and they're helpful. But you know, the problem is not having enough books and not having enough information, but trying to cut it up 10 pieces to where we can all get something out of it, and hopefully it's useful. So that's what I'm going to be trying to do over the next 10 lessons, if you will. So before we launch into tonight's lesson, would you bow with me, and we'll have a word of prayer, and then we'll start. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for giving us another day to stand before you, to worship you, to study your word. We thank you that we have this opportunity to come together and have all these classes for all different ages so that everyone can study and be more prepared to do your will. As we enter into this study of the history of Israel, we pray that we might address it in a way that everyone can learn more about the rich history of your people. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. We can't just launch into the Exodus. You know, I'll give you a little background, and we'll try to be this be very brief, but we'll start back with Abraham. That's where it all started. We could go back further to Adam, but I don't think we need to go back that far. So we'll go back to Abraham's call. We'll look at Israel to Egypt, how they got there, why they were there, what they did, how long they were there. And then finally we'll address the Exodus, the wandering in the wilderness, taking the land, the order of Judges, the monarchy established, and finally Saul's reign. And, you know, we'll cover Exodus, Numbers, Joshua, Judges, and 1 Samuel in a very brief fashion. So fasten your seat belts, and let's see how this is going to work. They're all descended from Abraham. And we know nothing about Abraham except that he was called by God. We don't know if he had a relationship with God before he was called. He was called, he was living in Ur of the Chaldees, which is down in Babylon. He told him to leave his country, leave his people, and go to a place that he would take him to. And he told him that he would be a great nation, and not only would he be a great nation, but he would be a father of many nations. And not only that, through him, all people of the earth would be blessed. And then after he started on the journey, he got down into Canaan, and he promised him that the land of Canaan would belong to his descendants at some point in the future. Abraham, started off being named Abram, wandered through the land for 100 years. He was 75 years old when he left Haran, and he died when he was 175 years old. So that's how I know he wandered around for 100 years. He never owned any of that land except one little plot that he bought to bury his wife, Sarah. His descendants were kind of a mixed breed. Sarah was thought God needed some help, that through Abraham's descendants, all these blessings would flow, and he didn't have any descendants. So she gave Abraham Hagar, her maidservant, as a concubine, so that he could have some descendants. And so Ishmael was born of that union. But God might be able to flow, but he was not, he didn't neglect the promises he made. So when Abraham was 100 years old, Sarah had Isaac. They had twins, Jacob and Esau. And then after Sarah passed on, Abraham had a relationship either as a concubine or a wife to Keturah. Now, all of these people, all of these men had, you might say, nations that descended from them. And we'll cross their paths as we go through this study. Ishmael had 12 sons, just like Jacob. Most of the Arabian people descended from Ishmael. Jacob and Esau were twins born of Isaac. God decided that even though Esau was a little bit older, that Jacob was going to be the one that was through the which the blessings would flow. The sons of Keturah. I didn't count them. There's a number of sons that Abraham had through Keturah. One of them is of interest, Midian. And we'll run across the Midianites later. We'll also run across the Edomites, which descended from Edom. We don't have Lot mentioned up here, but Lot, Abraham's nephew, had two sons. And the Ammonites and the Moabites descended from Lot. So all of these nations, Israel crossed paths with them, usually in a very unfavorable situation. They didn't act like they were cousins or whatever. They weren't very friendly, but we'll run across the descendants of those people as we go along. Jacob, as I say, was the one through which the promise was going to be fulfilled. He fathered 12 sons whose families migrated down into Egypt. And for what it's worth, got to have a little map. Here shows the world in the time of the patriarchs. And you see the little path that shows where Abraham left Babylon and traveled on down in to Canaan and finally down in. He spent some time down in Egypt, back and forth. We'll study this the whole. There's a lot of traffic up and down this along the coast over there. I just called Golden something or other, I forgot now. But it was a very fertile area. It was a very favorable place for traffic between the east and the west. So a lot of countries fought over that little plot of ground down on the eastern bank of the Mediterranean. Okay, where am I pointing? Well, finally. I'll show you some historical things occasionally. This is something called the Merneptah Stele. Merneptah was a pharaoh in Egypt, and he invented this thing for himself, and he claimed that Israel is desolate and has no seed left. That was inscribed on it. And that is the first reference, historically, presumably, to Israel. Not clear what battle he claims he fought, and when he, there are a couple of different theories I won't even bring up, but that's the earliest reference to Egypt from historical worldly sources. Joseph's history is covered in chapter 39-47. We can't cover all that tonight. Joseph was a favorite son of Jacob. His brothers were jealous of the treatment he got, favorable treatment he got, so they sold him as a slave into Egypt. And that was how they got started out of Egypt. He had a lot of special gifts that God gave him, one of which was to interpret, with God's help, dreams. The Pharaoh at that time had a dream, and he needed help interpreting that dream. So Joseph told him what the dream meant, is that you're going to have 7 years of great prosperity here in Egypt. And then you're going to have 7 years of famine. and he developed a plan for Pharaoh to deal with that. So Pharaoh put him in charge, and he became the second most powerful guy in Egypt. And that's how he found favor with the... and I got to tell you, his family back home are suffering from the famine up in Canaan. They needed some grain, so the brothers came down, made a couple of trips. Anyway, I won't go into detail about that, but anyway, that wound up with the whole tribe of Jacob coming down, moving down to Egypt. And because of Joseph's relationship with the Pharaoh, he gave them a nice area of land to live in. And so things were great. However, new king rose who didn't know Joseph. You know, that happens sometimes. You know, he didn't know of all the good things Joseph did. And so he was afraid because the children of Israel were propagating at a much faster pace than his people were. Now, the question is who his people were. Historically, people think it was the Hyksos. The people called the Hyksos came into Egypt somewhere along this time and basically took over. And it's not clear who they were or where they came from. But it's hard to believe that the Egyptians were outnumbered by the Israelites. So historians think these were the Hyksos. There were a small number of them, but they somehow took control of Egypt. But anyway, they decided they needed to do something to control the Israelites. So they decided to make them slave laborers and thought that would curtail their ability to produce children, but that didn't work. They did the work, suffered under the slave labor conditions. But then they decided, well, okay, if we can't control them that way, we'll kill the babies. And there were two instances there. One, where Pharaoh commanded the midwives to kill the little boy babies and leave the girls alone. Well, that didn't work either. The midwives said, well, these mothers are so quick, we can't get there in time. So, after a while, he just put out an edict to all of Egypt. All of Egypt, kill all the boy babies and leave the girls alone. Now, we don't know what the result of that was, except there was one thing that came out of it, and that was that Moses was saved by his family. His mother put him in a little basket and put him down in the water, and Pharaoh's daughter was down there, and they found the little baby, and she decided she would adopt him as her son. And in fact, hired his mother to be his nurse. So that's how Moses became a member of Pharaoh's family. When Moses was about 40 years old, he went down. His mother must have taught him about who he was and who his people were. He went down to visit his people. And while he was there, he killed an Egyptian. And that put him in some trouble with Pharaoh. So he had to leave the country. I mentioned Midian a while ago. He went up to Midian. And met with Jethro and his family and married one of his daughters, Zipporah. And he was doing fine up there until one day he saw this burning bush. The bush was on fire, but it didn't burn up. And God spoke to him and said, I'm going to send you back to Egypt to rescue my people and bring them out. And after some argument back and forth, God finally convinced him that with Aaron's help, he was going to go down and do the mission that he had for him. So I say, with Aaron's help in confrontation with Pharaoh, to show God's power through 10 miracles, the last of which was the death of the firstborn males, Pharaoh finally gave up and said, you can go. So they started off, and this is finally where we get to the Exodus. They left, and on that occasion, God set their calendar to zero and established their first of several annual events, the Feast of the Passover, and they started. You know, I don't want you to pay much attention to all this stuff up here. I started out trying to, fill in this, and we'll be back up. So just look at those orange or yellow, whatever colors those threes are. A lot of historians have put a lot of work into trying to develop a timeline that matches up, world history with the Bible. In Egypt, particularly. And they look at the pharaohs and when they reigned, and so they don't even agree on these names. You know, different ones have different names and different times. But let's go down and we can come up with dates for those three. Now, whether they're right, there's an argument about that as well. But Go back to 1 Kings. We've got to go 480 years forward and see what it says there. And it happened in the 480th year of the sons of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt. Fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel. In the month Ziph. In the second month, he began to build the house of Jehovah. Now, what does it say? 480 years after the sons of Israel came out of Egypt. Now, so what do we do with that? Well, most experts, authorities, think that Solomon began his reign about 1000 B.C. And a lot of them pick 970. So, okay, I'll pick 970. So, if Solomon began his reign in 970, and 4 years later he began to build the temple, that's 966. Then the date of the Exodus is 1446. How about that? So, and Moses was born 80 years old. He was 80 years old when they started, assuming all those miracles took place in 1 year, which may not be true. But anyway, he was 80 years old, let's say. So he was born then. A lot of people don't agree with those numbers. Some people say 480 is wrong. That, you know, the original words didn't say 480 years. It said so many generations. And if you take a generation to be so many years, you get 480. And well, they use the wrong number. So, in fact, there's a lot of controversy about the whole timeline. And there's one group of people that push everything forward either 200 or 300 years. So the dates I'm going to show you are the old dates as opposed to the new dates that some other people have. And I'll argue which is right. But this is like the book of Revelations. You know, the old dates and the new dates. But you've got people on both sides. One other thing, there were three times I asked you to look at. The other one was, when did they come down into Egypt? And the time of the sons Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. Okay? So, Exodus is 1446, minus 430 years, 1876. So, you know, we got three numbers based on that one little scripture in 1 Kings. And if it's right, you know, we got a pretty good peg on that. Now, there are other people who will argue with the 430 years. They say, well, the 430 years actually included the time they were over in Canaan before they came down into Egypt. I don't know where they get that. But that helps prop up the late date theory. So, anyway, that's about all I want to say about dates. Now, we finally get to the Exodus. And nobody agrees on what the path was. I'll show two or three there. There's the upper and the lower and the middle and all that. But you know, these have been argued about for years. Now we got a new player in the game who has a whole different idea. A guy named Steve Rudd came up with the route, he says. Now he's got a lot of. You know, we could spend the rest of the. You know, of course, studying his mouth, probably. But he's a somewhat controversial character who, I guess he claims to be a member of the church. I'm not sure. He has a relationship with Don Patton, who's a supposedly well-known creation. In fact, Don was a member here back in the 80s, so we know Don Patton. But I've seen some things that link those two together. But anyway, Rudd came up with this map, and Mark Ogles treated this, if you studied on his geography class, he talked about this map a lot. And kind of the secret to breaking the code, according to Rudd, was way down here. Now, if I can make this work, am I doing the right thing? Well, anyway, I can't make the laser work. I can't see it. Way down here where it says Migdol, there's a little gap in there. Most of the earlier maps didn't have that gap there. And there was a gap there. And so, anyway, that's part of kind of key to Rudd's theory that, well, they really went down there, and that's where they crossed the so-called Red Sea. And he said the Mount Sinai is over here in Midian. Because he says over here in Midian is where Moses saw the burning bush, and that's where he took people back. He makes a good argument about that. And some people, we don't know about that. And he presumably is very opinionated and supposedly said, well, if you don't agree with my math, then you don't believe the Bible. But anyway, he put forth a good argument. All right, so they went to Mount Sinai, and you know, in very soon after the Exodus, they spent a year there, and that's covered in Exodus 19 through 40. And here's where God made the first statement about establishing the nation of Israel. And now if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure to me above all nations, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. This is a promise he made and a promise he would keep as long as they would obey him. That's all he asked. And that was repeated, you know, in many ways and different fashions over the years. So he delivered the law and commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai in Exodus 20 through 23. Moses, you know, made two trips up there. And there's a lot of other stuff that we won't go into about fire and brimstone and the people being, you know, kept from getting close to the mountain or they're going to die and all this. But a lot of rich stuff in there if you got time to go back and read it. But the first time he went out, God gave him the commandment. He came back and he basically recited it to them, apparently, delivered it to the people, and then he wrote it down. And then God wrote it on tablets of stone. Now he returned again to Mount Sinai, and God was going to tell him some more stuff then. So he went up there for 40 days, and God gave him instructions on building the ark and the tabernacle. And not only just the tabernacle, but all the furnishing that went into the tabernacle, and all the garments the priests would wear, and all of the ceremonies that they would go through, and how the different tribes would line up on the four sides of the tabernacle when they would camp. And all that detail is spelled out in there. Now what happened? Okay, we've got trouble brewing back at the camp. The people, they just kept causing trouble. You know, they just kept thinking things would have been better if we just stayed in Egypt. And anyway, Moses is gone. We know where he's been gone 40 days. So we need something to worship. And so Aaron built him this golden calf. And in fact, God told Moses while he was up on the mountain, you've got to get back down there because your people are doing really bad things. So Moses went back. And before he went back, God threatened to I'm just going to destroy them all, and I'm going to start it all over with you. And Moses said, no, you don't want to do that, because think of your reputation. That you've showed your power and bringing all these people out of Egypt, and they will say, you know, you weren't really as powerful as you thought you were. So he went finally, and this is not the only time that Moses had to convince God not to destroy the people and start all over. So, He did not destroy the people. Whoops. He came back, confronted Aaron. Moses was so mad he broke the tablets. Moses had the Levites kill a bunch of the Israelites as punishment for some of this. And God replaced the tablets of stone. Here's a picture that, based on the script in the Bible, somebody drew up. And there's actually a model up here in somewhere in Pennsylvania. Some of you may have been to the model of the of the tabernacle. I've never been up there. Model of the ark, and that's used on the cover. A lot of people think, well, the law of Moses, that's the first real code that people had. But that's not really true. The most well known is the Hammurabi Code back in 1780, was developed in Babylon. Anyway, that's just casual interest, if you will. Moses developed his in 1445 because they came out in 1446 and developed it a year later. This is something called the Hammurabi Stele. It has his laws, commandments, whatever, engraved on that stone. Shows his God, whatever his name was, delivered it to him sitting up on top. That's over in Paris, France, if you want to go see it. Well, okay, one. All right, bye. They left Sinai, went over to the wilderness of Paran. God told Moses to send some spies into the land. You want to come check it out, see what's there? So Moses selected one person from each tribe, sent them off. They came back. Everybody said, bad stuff. You know, it's a great land. A lot of good. Brought back one cluster of grapes and took two guys to carry it. I said, they're giants. Oh, we look like ants or grasshoppers or something in front of those people. Everybody but Joshua and Caleb. Because of that, he said, okay, that's enough. I'm going to let you wander around in the wilderness for 40 years. 1 year for the, each day that they were going, doing their little mission. And all of you that are adults, like 20 or 21 and over, are going to die. We're going to keep you wandering around until you're all dead. You won't go. And they were guided by cloud, fed by manna. Many instances of people murmuring and wanting to return to Egypt. I say Jehovah was attempted to destroy all the people. One time Moses goofed up, but he's not allowed to enter. We'll go on the next page. Okay. Maybe I need to get in front of this thing, huh? Okay. Bitter water at Meribah. The water was bitter. They didn't like the water. So God had Moses throw a tree in there, and it would sweeten the water, and that was okay. They ran out of food. I can't remember what happened here, but another place where they run out of... I believe this is where they... maybe that's where he gave them the quail to eat. Until they just got tired of quail. But here was an occasion where, again, they ran out of water, and God told Moses to strike the stone with his and water came out. There's one place here where it doesn't know what they're just complaining. What they're complaining about. And so God set fire around the camp, killed a bunch of them, and Moses kind of begged him off, and he quit. They didn't like, you know, they didn't have melons and cucumbers and stuff like that, and meat and all that stuff like we used to really enjoy down in Egypt. You know, we really need some of that. Well, I think this is the one where they eat something with quail. Then they run out of water again at Kadesh, and this is where Moses got in trouble. God told him to speak to the rock, and water would come out, and Moses struck the rock, and that wasn't the problem. I mean, that was God could overlook that. But he said, must we bring forth water for you out of the rock? We, as if Moses was a part of the process. And because of that statement, God said, you won't go into the land. So that's Moses' discipline for that. Anyway, I don't know if I covered all of the incidents of murmuring and complaining, but finally, after 40 years, and we won't, there's a lot of detail in those 40 years, a lot of things went on, some good things, some bad things, but finally they got over on the east side of the Jordan River and getting ready to move up and into the land. They had a few battles over there. The armies of Sihon and Og, they were Amorite kings. They defeated them, occupied their territories, and the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh said, we like this land. We just take this. And Moses said, okay, but you've got to send your army with us. You've got to go over and help us capture the land. And if you agree to that, then you can have this land. So they agreed to that, and they went over with Moses and the... I mean, Joshua, I'm sorry. Because... Moses commissioned Joshua. He died. Then another miracle related to water. They crossed the Jordan River. God stopped the water upstream. They crossed over on dry land. Crossed kind of in the middle of Canaan, and he had expeditions both north and south to capture the land rather than just go in one and start up. First battle was, or incident was at Jericho. Walls fell down. They were defeated at Ai because Achan took some of the stuff and buried it under his tent. They found out about it. He was punished. They went on and were victorious. A lot of victories up and down, north and south. And they never completely kicked everybody out. They never completely conquered the land. But they worked on it pretty hard. Here's the this little mountain. Basically shows just north of the Dead Sea. They went in and went north and south to... there's a little sidelight. there's some things called the Amarna tablets that were prepared somewhere in this time frame. There's about, I think, 300 or 400 of them that were uncovered. And they were kind of administrative correspondence, if you will, between some of the countries up there in Canaan and even some over in Babylon, between those people and the Pharaoh or the Pharaoh's minions down in Egypt. And one thing they kept talking about is there's these new people up here that are causing us some trouble, and you need to send some help. And they're just one example of, may the king direct his attention to the archers, and may the king and the Lord send troops of archers. The king has no more land. The Haparu, may refer to Hebrews, sacked the territory of the king. Some people think that was one version of Hebrew. A lot of people say, no, that's not true. But it's about the right time that all these things were being written, that Joshua was bringing the people into the land. Philistines. You know, we just have a lot about the Philistines as we get into this. Long-time enemies of Israel. They migrated after the collapse. Presumably maybe came out of the Hittite area, but either there or the Mycenaeans, whatever. Actually, the land of Palestine presumably was a variation of Philistia. Some of their literature, the Egyptians refer to them or them and along with some other people as the sea people. These are people that sailed down and invaded Egypt, tried to take over Egypt. Didn't work. They were sent back. So they came up instead and moved into Canaan. And that's where they were when the nation was settled. And you have five cities that you run across these, you know, during subsequent times that where they were causing a lot of trouble. They were militarily and technically superior to Israel. Israel's been down in Egypt 400 years. You know, they didn't have an army. They didn't know how to do iron stuff. And the Philistines were warriors, warrior people. They came out of that heritage, so they knew how to fight. They this was just kind of between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, and they knew how to make iron stuff. And when they, you know, were ruling over Israel, they wouldn't let them have a smith. Get their plows sharpened, they had to go down and get the Philistine smithy to sharpen their hoes and the plows and stuff. So they were at a great disadvantage, both militarily and technically. They were finally defeated by David many years later. Here's a little map that kind of shows where they were, and this is about the beginning of David's reign. The little cities with the circles on them, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gath, and Ekron, those were their cities. They were independent city-states. Each city had its own king or mayor or something that ruled the Okay, here's the way the... I'm sure you've seen this map many times. This is how the land was divided up amongst the tribes. It says the 11 tribes. Okay. Why are only 11 tribes in there? And why are there... there are not 11 tribes up there. Who didn't get... Which tribe didn't get any? Levi. He got cities. All right. No land. Now notice there's... Okay. Ephraim and Manasseh. They weren't sons. No wonder they get any. Joseph. They were sons of Joseph. They were sons of Joseph. So they got Joseph's share. Now you notice that Manasseh got two pieces. He was the one who said, hey, I'll take this thing over here on the east side. Well, presumably he was so successful when they moved over capturing a territory that Joshua gave him some more. So he had stuff on both sides of the river, if you will. I need to stay home, don't I? There we go. Period of Judges, we'll cover this very briefly. No successor. Moses had chosen Joshua as his successor. That wasn't one for when Joshua went away. But we see that in those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Now that's, you know, I didn't get a lot of trouble with that kind of rule. They were often disobedient. God would send somebody he would punish them first. And then they would say, oh, we're going to change. You know, we're going to be obedient. Help us out. And he would send somebody to help them. Joshua raised up judges who delivered them out of the hands of those who spoiled them. And the deliverance deliverer would lead them in battle and maybe rule over them for a while. And I think typical behavior, this is where they were worshiping idols and marrying into the various tribes of Mesopotamia. And so God sent the king of Mesopotamia down, and he went out over them and ruled over them for 8 years. And, sure enough, people cried. You know, when the sons of Israel cried, Jehovah rose Othniel, and he went in, defeated the king of Mesopotamia, and ruled for 40 years. So that's a pretty good period of time. Some other notables, we won't spend a lot of time. And Hebrews mentions four during this time. Barak wasn't a judge, but he worked with Deborah, who was a judge, pretty successfully. Jephthah, you know, he did a bad thing. He basically promised after a successful venture that he would sacrifice the first thing he came out to meet him, and it was his daughter. So he had to sacrifice her. Samson wasn't a very godly man, I don't think, but he's mentioned as one of the heroes, if you will. Okay. Now we're going to get to one of the good guys of this period, Samuel. Samuel probably doesn't get as much credit as he should get, you know, for what he did. Let's put it that way. During this time, Eli was the highest priest and judge. His sons were priests. And the word of Jehovah was rare in those days. He wasn't talking to him. Nobody was being told anything, apparently. Now, Eli, he could talk to God because we get down here. Hannah was one of two wives of a man named Elkanah. She wouldn't have any babies. She prayed that she would give one. Eli saw her, you know, mouthing her prayer, thought she was drunk. He went down and spoke to her and said, "No, I was praying." Told her what she was praying for. And so Eli spoke to God and she had her son. So that's what I say. He apparently had prayed to God, talked to God, but apparently God didn't talk to him. So Samuel was the answer to her prayers. She took him up when he was, you know, that's what, 3 or 4 years old, and basically gave him to Eli. Take care of him. Because I promised God that I would give him my firstborn son if I had one. So he was established as a prophet. Jehovah did talk to him. He revealed stuff to Samuel that he didn't talk to. Didn't anyone else. Suddenly they began to be successful. No, they're not successful yet. Up here. They had this battle with the Philistines. The Philistines defeated them, captured the ark, took it back home. Sons of Eli were killed. And when Eli heard it, he fell over backward, broke his neck, he died. So, great impact. So Samuel rose to the occasion. He took the place of Eli, routed Israel. He was not of the priestly tribe, but he basically took on the duties of the priest, if you will. They had destroyed everything up at wherever. So he went on a circuit and offered sacrifices at various places. He got the Philistines actually brought the ark back. They were having bad things happen then. So he put it up there in the home of Abinadab and stayed there for a long time. Okay, Samuel didn't have a successor. They didn't like his sons. They weren't good men. They did have bad things done at the, not the temple, but wherever it was. They said, "We want a king. We want a king like these other people do. Well, we want these sons of Samuel." And Samuel took it as a reflection on him. And God said, "No, it's not your fault. I'm not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. So listen to them." He went over a whole list of things that's going to happen. If you get a king, he's going to come and take your children. He's going to tax you. He's going to get your money. He's going to do all this bad stuff if you get a king, because that's what kings do. They said, "Oh, we want one. We want him to judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." So Saul was chosen as the man. Some versions say the prince of Israel. There was not a man among the sons of Israel more handsome than he, being taller than any of the people from his head and shoulders, is what we call that. he was out looking for the lost donkeys of his father, and Samuel told him, "You're going to be the king." And he says, "You've got to be kidding." And Samuel said, "Okay, I'm going to tell three things are going to happen that you'll know what I'm telling you is true." And he'd find the donkeys, he'd meet three men going to worship, and you would meet some prophets that are prophesying, and you'd prophesy. So he got the message, but he went and met with his uncle, which may have been Abner, we don't know. He didn't even say anything to him about, "Hey, I've just been appointed the king." Because he didn't know what kings did, I guess. So he just went home and said, "Okay, I'm the king." Okay, so I want to compare Saul with David briefly. Humble, timid, even though he's a big man. And later, self-willed, jealous, suspicious, paranoid, subject to aggression. He just went all pieces. Killed the prophets. You know, David had gone up and got some bread from the prophets, and Saul sent a guy up there, and he killed all 80-something of the prophets. He's tried over several years to kill David, and they had conflicts with Samuel. Did not follow Jehovah's directions explicitly, but he was successful on the battlefield. I also had a simple, small government, low, small army, low taxes, all that changed, especially when we get up to Solomon's time. But David, people can't agree what David meant. Some people think it meant beloved, other people say leader. But anyway, they would call him a Renaissance man. You know, he's a man of multi-dimensions. He was a poet. He was a musician. He was called a heroic figure. He killed the bear and the lion to protect his father's sheep. He killed the giant Goliath. He military strategist. He would adapt the military strategy to the situation he was in. He did guerrilla warfare, we would call it, for years before Saul passed on. Later, he became quite successful as a leader of Israel. A very inspirational leader. People believed him, followed him. And this is the best thing you can say about anybody, David. Because David did what was right in the eyes of Jehovah and did not turn aside from all that he commanded him all the days of his life except the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And if you don't know what that is, go back and read about Uriah the Hittite. Okay. And talking about Saul being a successful military man, here's some of the battles that he was successful in. I mentioned he stopped off at his uncle's house. Didn't say anything about the fact that he had been appointed king. I'm trying to say, where was it? People over at Jabesh. The Ammonites came over and said, "Okay, we're going to rule over you." And they said, "Okay, but we'd like for you to sign an agreement, and we'll worship, we'll work for you." And they said, "Well, before we do that, we want each one of your men to gouge out his right eye. You know, that then we'll sign a covenant with you and you'll serve us." And they said, "Well, that's pretty hard." So they said, "Well, look, let us see if we can get some help. And if we can't get any help, then we'll do what you say." So they sent out the word. Saul got the word. And he rallied an army of 330,000 men. And they went over and defeated the Ammonites. Handily. He cut up a yoke of oxen, and I guess he sent a piece to each one of the tribal areas and said, "Come." And 300,000 came from all the other tribes and 30 from Judah. And they went over and defeated the Ammonites. And they all met at Gilgal and commissioned Saul the king. Okay, now this is the kind of guy we want. He led us in battle, defeated the enemy. And I won't do all of these. The Amalekite War, now that's the one where Saul really got in trouble. He was told to go up and destroy everything. All the animals, all the people. But he didn't do that. He kept Agag, the king, brought him back, took the choices of the animals, and he said, "Well, we were going to sacrifice all those animals. They're nice animals. We're going to sacrifice." God said, "That's not the point. You know, to obey is better than sacrifice." So that's where Saul really started downhill, if you will. Second Philistine War. Now, this is where David emerged as a hero. He defeated Goliath, came back. People honored him more than Saul. So that's where their relationship started downhill. The people said, Saul, killed his thousands. David killed his hundreds of thousands. And that created jealousy from Saul. He became him. So from then forward, he repeatedly was trying to kill David. And David was off, hiding out, doing guerrilla warfare, that kind of stuff. And he could have killed Saul many times, let him go. Final battle with the Philistines, Saul and three of his sons killed. And David, who had already been anointed king of Samuel when he was a young man, so then he took over and gradually became a very powerful person in the history of Israel. Now, I'm not going to be here next week, but Mark Ogles is going to start the Kingdom of David and go forth. And I've got a... this wasn't useful tonight, so I've got a little outline, if you will, for the rest of the class, for those who want one.